December 1999. We're in the Fireside Room this morning. The presenter's name is Maya Baumgartner. Session number is BAMI 99-4. This morning, Maya gives Bible study from the Book of John. Let's listen in.
I'm Baumgartner, and I'm the village pastor, and roll tape. This is a study on John's prologue, the first chapter of the Gospel of John, verses 1 through 14, or 1 through 18. And that will be the text that we'll be preaching on Christmas Day. So, and it will also come up again in the lectionary the second Sunday after Christmas. So we hear it a couple of times. So if you'd like to turn to John 1, that would be helpful because we're going to do a lot of word study. And if you need to take breaks during the study just to warm up your hands, go ahead. This John was one of the last of the Gospels that were written. And the first part of this Gospel actually reads like a hymn. And so it may well have been a hymn recounting the story of salvation. And you can see verses and the way that its rhythm goes. It almost seems like a hymn. And it was written for a community that was formed around the beloved disciple, the disciple John, or around John the Baptist. Scholars really aren't sure. But it was a community. The Gospel of John was written after the other Gospels, around 90 A.D., but it is believed that they were a community that that either formed around John the Baptist or the disciple, and so that gives it also some of its character. It's not considered a synoptic gospel. It doesn't have an infancy story in it. It doesn't have a lot of the stories that Matthew, Mark, and Luke share. And so it's kind of always been a gospel that's been on its own and a little suspicious by some, but it's just its characteristic, I guess. So let's begin by reading this hymn of salvation. That will also be our prayer too, from John 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify to the light, so that all might believe through him. He himself was not the light, but he came to testify to the light. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world came into being through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to what was his own, and his own people did not accept him. But to all who received him, who believed in him, in his name, he gave the power to become children of God, who were born not of blood or of the will of the flesh or of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. And then I skip to 16. From his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. This is the word of life.
Thanks be to God.
Mm-hmm. A few words. You notice a few words that come out, that seem to be overlapping. What seems to be repeated all the time in this prologue as you were listening? The word, okay. Word's a big word. What else?
Light.
Uh-huh.
Life.
And life. Yep. Those three words really shape this entire gospel, and you can learn a lot about the entire gospel actually from this prologue. We'll be talking about all of those words, well, mostly word and life today. But first I'd like to talk about word, and the word for word is logos, and the Greek word for word is logos. And there was a lot of logos theology, hi Warren, going on in that day. And there's one history, I'll just talk about two histories. One is the Hellenistic, the Greek tradition of the logos, and then the other is the Hebrew tradition, and how those really inform this text. And I think they're really, really exciting. For the wisdom or the tradition for the Hellenistic age, in about the 6th century BC, this became a category by a philosopher called Heraclitus. And the category was this logos philosophy. And it explained basically the continuity of, amid all the flux in the universe, how order is made out of chaos, this world of order. And so that was just a philosophy of the time. And also many Stoics of the age thought that logos, they related that to the mind of God. It was related to that which controlled all things or organized all things. And Philo thought that logos was this word or whatever that was something that was created by God as an intermediary to work with God. So you see, what you're going to see is all these different themes kind of coming together. But one thing that wasn't really in Greek thought was that the word would become flesh and dwell with us. So that's kind of the surprise ending for this prologue, that if a Greek was reading it with that background of the philosophy, that would be of large surprise to them, that the word became flesh and dwelled among us. And we'll spend more time on that verse later. The other type of thought, so here you have a group of people who would be thinking that that logos is the mind of God, or when they hear the word, they think the mind of God or this organizing force. And then you also have the Hebrew thought of the day, which was is the wisdom tradition that echoes a lot of the same themes as the word. I'm just going to read a few verses. We see wisdom personified often as the breath of God, or created before creation, present in the beginning with God, as this prologue talks about. And from Proverbs 8:22, the Lord created me at the beginning of the Lord's work, the first act of long ago. Ages ago I was set up at the first, before the beginning of the earth. So here you see this woman wisdom, or this personified wisdom, that was there in the beginning with God, and is part of that creative act, also part of continuing that creation. Also in Proverbs 8, we read, "For whoever finds me, wisdom, finds life and obtains favor from the Lord." Again, we hear those echoes, "In him was life." There's also a sense of hospitality with wisdom. From Proverbs 9, we read, "Come and eat of my bread and drink of my wine I have mixed. Set aside immaturity and live, and walk in the way of insight." Another, again, you get a sense of enlightenment to this light grasping, and also the sense of hospitality. And also in Proverbs 8:2, we see wisdom is concerned with justice and just relationships. Wisdom walk in the way of righteousness along the paths of justice. She gathers the community and she reaches out to the poor. So there's a lot of these themes that we're going to see in the person of Jesus too, that we see in this person of wisdom in the Old Testament. And a lot of that in our books, in our Bibles, will be in Proverbs. And actually that's worth looking at in Proverbs 8 and 9. You see a lot in those two chapters. And then you see some in some of the intertestamental books, which in a couple, it's not in our Protestant Bible, or but it's in it's literature that was written after the Torah was decided upon and before really the time of Christ. And you have books like called The Wisdom of Solomon, Sirach, a couple books like that, which are in the Oxford Study Bible, and you'll also find it in the Harper Study Bible. And those have a lot of words of wisdom, but words about wisdom in them. So I really get excited when I talk about wisdom, because I think that it opens up a whole other part of the Old Testament, and it really also gives a feminine image, a pretty strong feminine image for a creator or someone who's with the creator, and of God, a little feminine image of God. And I think that just kind of expands our view. And it was a tradition that many of the, we see it actually come up in 1 Corinthians, verse 24, Paul writes that Christ is the wisdom of God, and he's leaning on that tradition of wisdom. So those are the things that when we look at the Greek thought and the Hebrew thought that are informing this. So let's get to the text, because that's the fun part. The first verse is the first two verses, in the beginning. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. We have here, in the beginning, what do you think of when you hear those words?
Creation story of Genesis.
Yeah, immediately. And I think that the writer of John, that's exactly what he was going after. He brings us back to that Genesis, so that something new is being created here, and something new is happening again, and he wants to get our attention, and also to connect us to that tradition. And this is also the same word that would have been used in, there's a Greek, most of the Torah is written in Hebrew, of course, but then there was also a Greek version when people started speaking Greek of the Old Testament called the Septuagint, and that's exactly the same word that was used there. So these readers who would probably be reading a Greek Old Testament would definitely hear that. So in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. That also can be thought of as like accompaniment, the Word was with God, or that there's a sense of movement there, a sense of moving towards God, and in a more active sense. And that that's kind of a subtle translation point, but to get a sense of this movement of creation. Let's finish this all. Yeah. And the Word, it goes on that the Word was God. So he's kind of developing this argument that the Word is divine. All things came into being, and here we can start the second verse. All things came into being through him, and with him not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Now, the word all things came into being, again, that's a word, a Genesis word. Actually, the Greek word is egeneto, and so it looks just like Genesis. It's that same word. So once again, we have this bringing back the themes of creation. And this idea, too, that God is the creator of all things, not just humans or, just everything that you can think of. This is the awesomeness of this God. Everything that you can think of in this world came into being, and without which nothing could have come into being. And I think the highlight of this verse is, in him was life. This is the word zoe, which John uses throughout all of this gospel, and it's fun to try to pick that out throughout the gospel. This is a life that's not just like someone, not our lives that we have that you know, we can die. And it's a life that no death can overcome. It's an eternal, abundant sort of life. And so it's this, it's a large word. And one theme that John has is that it's not an eternal life that you have to wait for, you know. We sometimes get into that theology where we think, okay, well, I'm just biding my time until, you know, I can see Jesus or whatever. And I think what John is trying to bring in is that God is breaking into this world and bringing us this abundant life now. And now there is this life, this abundant life. And what do we, you know, what do we do with that? How do we experience that? Do we understand that grace? So we're not waiting for this life, but it's just coming to us, and we're living it now. And what implications does that have for our life? I don't know if there's any comments. Yeah.
How do you spell that?
Zoe. I guess it'd probably be Z-O-A is how we'd spell that.
Say that. Then the other and the second in him was life, and the life was the light.
Same word.
That's the same.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the life was the light of, the Greek is all men or all people. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's not all. It just says people. The life was the light of people. Yeah. Does that, knowing that, I mean, does that, what do you think about that, living eternal life now? What does...
It changes it, because mm-hmm. I have thought that's dying and going to heaven is the mm-hmm. culmination of, that you get your reward and you're, you know...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, those kind of, I mean, things that...
Sure.
And so this, it doesn't put pressure on, but there's more accountability. There's more, like, so you don't just sit around. There's more happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a person who decides that they're wanting to follow Christ and make God part of their life, then there's some intentional happening, because you have that life right now. You can, there's no excuse, like, mm-hmm. just to kind of sit.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. To me, exciting and challenging. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at this one.
Hmm.
Okay, I don't have to wait. I can, and I've heard the thing that the statement that heaven is here now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to wait. And so this is kind of that.
Yeah.
Brought to light. So
yeah. And the light was the light of all, light of people. Yes. Yeah, there's another layer. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth.
Yeah, it's a layer also to the discussion of yesterday when we were talking about journey, that that part of you know, we said that looking at the Isaiah text from Advent, that the here and the now is also very important, and that the journey and the comfort and waiting and all of that part of waiting is knowing that there, you know, that the hope of the moment, so that you can continue to wait.
Mm-hmm.
So that there is a reason to take another step.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think you approach life differently,
mm-hmm.
because, mm-hmm. like you were saying, Kathleen, I think sometimes people go through life thinking, okay, when the kids go to school, when they're out of the house, or when I am no longer have a job, or when I'm not quite so busy, or when I retire, and all of a sudden you've wasted all of the life you had along the way,
mm-hmm.
waiting for ultimately a time when you didn't have to work, or a time mm-hmm. you waste the life mm-hmm. you have. And mm-hmm. so it teaches us to enjoy life
like
in
that.
Its fullest as we're going through it.
Yeah.
And if this is the kingdom now, then this is the holiness now, too.
Yeah.
So to me, it adds a whole dimension of holiness at this moment.
That's nice. Yeah.
And then heaven would be an extension of what we have here, just... maybe without the pain and the
mm-hmm.
yeah.
mm-hmm.
grief or whatever.
Yeah, I like that idea, Elizabeth, of the dimension of holiness, because that seems to put it in a really That's a little nice kernel to think about, you know, because if you think of every moment of what you're doing or every encounter with people as holy, it really just changes how one reacts or what that moment is, you know.
And another dimension of that is, I was just thinking about holy, which Ryan is sacred, but if we think that we're always walking in sacred space, how does that shift then how we approach things?
Mm-hmm.
If we're walking in sacred space, this aluminum can that I, you know, that I see here, that's now also part of sacred space. So it seems to me that it makes it creates a different kind of stewardship.
Of
what we have.
Yeah. That is a really good tie-in to later in this passage of, we'll pick up some of those themes of walking in sacred space. Good. Okay. Let's see.
Actually, I didn't think of any of those things. Maya just paid me a little bit.
Thanks. You guys are working out. How many of you aren't plants here? No, just kidding. Okay, so we have this life that death cannot destroy. It's also, I should have been looking this up, 22:2.
What are you doing
there? Yeah.
I also thought it was interesting to know that, but in verse 2, that the beginning was the word was with God, and the word was God, and then he, so it personalizes it there. It comes to a personal pronoun from kind of this impersonal, the word, and you know, this kind of, so it really makes it much more, it starts to narrow it there, and then so that it's starting to come down.
And it, so the light, verse 5, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. That, the word for overcome, is an interesting word that actually goes throughout this text a lot. The root is lambano, which means, can't really think of an English word that works really well with it, but it means to seize. There's a sense of seizing when you use that word. And this is to katalambano, which is to seize down. Later in the text, we'll see where it's paralambano, which is to take from the side. I mean, there's a, depending on what your prefix is, you know, it's kind of how are you seizing this. And this word for seize can be thought of in a lot of different ways. I mean, it can be translated, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness, and we have did not overcome it, and the darkness did not grasp it. You know, that'd be that seizing sense. Or understand. We talk, and that's actually in English, we also, when we use the word to grasp, we see that that can be a physical thing, or it can be a mental activity of, I didn't really grasp what you were saying. So that's also, there's also a twofold meaning in this word too, the darkness not grasping the light. It can also mean a sense of receiving or accepting. The darkness did not accept the light or appreciate the light, or conquer. It can have more of a sense of that conquering, that physical grasping. So there's a lot of meanings to play with here. And also another good theological discussion right here too, of what does it mean that, you know, what is John's sense of darkness and light, of good and evil in this, in his theology? You know, what is he telling us here? I think some of the, you know, the light shines in the darkness did not overcome it. We say this all the time in Vespers. How many times does that go past us? And what are we, you know, what do you think of then? Do you think of, you know, we haven't, I think what I hear is what isn't said is that the darkness is still there in this text. It's not like we hear that the light shines and overcomes the darkness, you know. We don't quite hear that triumphalism. We hear still a tension of light and dark, of you know, what could be seen as good and evil of in this.
How would that vary, though, with the Hebrew thought versus the Greek thought?
Yeah.
I think two different concepts in their minds, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think they're in tension with each other at this point, because you do have the Gnostics, who really liked the Gospel of John later on, enjoyed it because they could read in a lot of dualism, a lot of, you know, here's the light, here's the dark, and they liked to have, you know, they had their theology was more of a sense of things, you know, of this was created by, you know, the good is created by God, and the other is created by a more evil demiurge, a little evil figure. But the Hebrew thought was always much more holistic, you know, that God was creator of all things, and which is said right here too. So how does that play out? That, you know, does God create everything, or do we have this battle of two forces, or how does this work? And maybe I'm overthinking it, but I think that it just brings up another good theological piece. Yeah.
Yeah. To me, I guess I don't identify it with a good and evil. Mm-hmm. I just think more of a term. And for me, you know, the symbol of the yin and the yang, where the within the light section is the dark section, mm-hmm. within the dark section is the light section.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, again, is much more holistic.
Mm-hmm.
That the darkness is in all of us.
Mm-hmm.
The light is in all
mm-hmm.
of us. And that, to me, it's a real hopeful thing, because that the light, the darkness will never overcome the light.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Does that more Gnostic than John?
Mm-hmm.
I think,
that's where the Gnostics, I think, took a lot of that.
You know, the light and the... There is light in us and darkness, and, you know, John is saying, I'm not light. Jesus is light.
Uh-huh.
So we have Jesus identified with the light here.
Mm-hmm. That the light comes into our darkness.
Yeah, so...
Mm, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, I think what you're referring to, I think that's the... That's a good thought, Elizabeth, because I think that is a popular thing today with the New Age,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of reading, and there's a lot of New Age stuff in a lot of our reading, and that light and darkness is in each of us. When
mm-hmm.
we produce our own light, or take away our own darkness, so our own light can shine,
mm-hmm.
and we don't, we get away from thinking that the light comes to us, is revealed to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you know, I don't
mm-hmm.
know, but I think that's a... Mm-hmm. really a turmoil in our society with New Age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and where does... Yeah, I think the source of that light. That's
yeah.
kind of what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'd like to read one thing from the Book of Wisdom. For she, wisdom, is more beautiful than the sun and excels every constellation of the stars. Compared with the light, she is found to be superior, for it is succeeded by the night, but against wisdom, evil does not prevail. There's again the sense of this figure in this figure within the group of God, and within God, that is that evil doesn't prevail against. And we have that with the Word and with this Jesus figure that's coming out in John. So I just wanted to again show you that parallel. Then we have this, I think what Warren said actually is a good segue into 6 through 9. This isn't really part of the hymn, and as I was talking about the hymn, I wonder if you noticed when you first read this, it doesn't read, this part doesn't read like a hymn at all. It just seems to be an insert. And I think it is. I think there's some really good reasons why this might have been inserted for the community of John, basically to say, once again, similar to what Warren was saying, that we're not the light, but testifying to the light. That's why John came. There was a man sent from God whose name was John, referring to John the Baptist, of course. He came as a witness to testify to the light so that all might believe through him. And the word testify is also the word for martyr. Actually, it is the word martyr. And in John's case, I mean, it's kind of interesting that that's a stronger word there. He came to testify to the light so that all might believe through him. He himself was not the light, but he came to testify to the light. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. I think that's all I have. Yeah. Any questions on that, or?
What would the Gnostics think of that?
I don't know.
Maya, if like you say, they took that gospel seriously, how would they? What would they think about this phrase, you know, the true light is other than them, than themselves, like they're arriving to the true light.
Two things. I mean, definitely you can see how they could use it to twist it and, and to kind of bring it a little bit closer to themselves. The true light which enlightens everyone. I mean, I would think the enlightened word would be something that would be pretty, which would go well with their theology. But the true light which enlightens everyone was coming into the world. Here, though, John is trying to say, obviously, that light is related to the Word, which is related to Christ. You know, is still making that point. So, he was in the world, and the world came into being through him. Yet the world did not know him. He came to what was his own, and his own people did not accept him. Here we have a sense now, in just two short phrases, of saying Christ's life here on earth. You know, it's very to the point. And once again, the word for did not accept him, or receive him, that's that lambano word I was talking about before. The darkness did not overcome it. Again, this is a word related to that, that receiving sense. So we see this word, paralambano.
And this is from the side?
This is from what?
You said that one of them was kind of a
front. Yeah, this was, and this is from the side, yeah. In verse 11, it's from the side. In verse 12, it's just the word, it's lambano itself. But it's paralambano for his own people did not accept him. Which
the negative of the lambano.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not the grasping, but it's the accepting, a side-to-side seizing, which would be kind of more accepting gesture.
So
it
kind of gives an impression of that kind of sneaky attack from the side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually. That's good. Him, that's that lambano word again, all who received him, who grasped him, who believed in his name, he gave the power to become the children of God. That word for power can also be used for he gave the right to become the children of God, or the authority. I kind of
I think it's not translated right a lot of times, because then we feel that's kind of a self, I think theologically that could have some pretty bad implications as far as feeling that, well, we owe it, we deserve to have this to become the children of God. But he gave them the authority or the power to become the children of God. And in the other Gospels, they'll talk about becoming the sons of God, and so we inclusify that, make that children. But here it really is children. John writes, uses only Son of God for Christ. And that's another question that I'd have. Let's see, how much time do we have? You know, what does that mean? Again, if we take our themes to have this life, this Zoe, this abundant life, to be witnesses to this light of Christ, and to be children of God. I mean, those are three incredible, I think, kind of earth-shaking ideas and promises. What does that mean for our lives when we walk on holy ground? And in verse 13, it says, gave us the power to become the children of God, who were born not of blood or of the will of the flesh or of the will of man, but of God. That's about as big as the nativity scene that you're going to see in John. but, you know, John wants to make quite clear that this was an act of God, solely an act of God. And there's one interesting piece that I'm just starting to roll this around in my mind, but the word for blood is actually plural, which is odd. So who were born not of bloods or of the will of the flesh or of the will of man, but of God? And this might be a stretch, but it was just surfaced up when I was reading the Raymond Brown commentary. And that was that bloods meant, you know, that could mean bloodshed if it's plural. And I thought, you know, we've never really thought about that. But that, you know, if that would give any more meaning to this text, that, you know, it wasn't some conquering of people or something like that. I mean, this child was born out of, not in violence or, you know, but, you know, or of some, you know, gods killing this god and, you know, any kind of mythology like that, but was born of God alone. And so it's just something I'm playing with. I haven't really developed that whole thought yet, but I just thought, you know, we're in this time of talking about nonviolence and that, and to see that, you know, kind of peripheral reference to bloodshed, I thought, I wonder how that fits. So,
is the will of the flesh, the will of man, is that kind of meaning the same thing? Or is there some kind of, and, you know, kind of spreading out of meaning there?
Yeah, and actually the will of man can also mean like the will of a husband. It's andros. Yeah, I think that means about the same thing. In a way that could also just be, you know, how if you say something, you know, three times or whatever, it's just emphasizes it more. But the will of flesh, that's the, you know, bodily, body oriented.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah. Well, it seems like if the will of man, that would be like the husband.
So yeah.
It wasn't just from blood or from lust or,
Or from her husband.
The marriage.
Mm-hmm. The marriage, right. Yeah, I think that's a better explanation. And then finally, we get to the 14th verse, one of my favorites. And the Word became flesh and lived among us. And we have seen his glory, the glory of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. And I'll read the verse 16 too, because they kind of go together. From his fullness, we have all received grace upon grace. There's some great words here. The Word became flesh and lived among us. That probably is perhaps my favorite word. That word actually is eskenosen, and skene was a tent. So it's the word for pitching your tent among us. If in the lesson on Sunday, the Old Testament lesson, they had that conversation between David and Nathan via God, of course, or God via Nathan, of David saying, hey, here we are. I want to build you a house, God. And God saying, I'm not really so interested in a house. I'll build you one. But God was, you know, God said, I've been moving about with my people. I've never needed a house before. And we have the tradition in, you know, when they were going across the desert from Egypt to Israel, that there was a tent, and that was the place, you know, Moses was instructed to have a tent and to put that up and to move it with the people, and that's where God's house would be. And so God was always amongst God's people, pitching a tent amongst God's people. And that's what this word, the word became flesh and lived among us. That's what that harkens back to, too, is that now we have this God who has come again in to be with the people, and even more so in the flesh, you know, not necessarily in a tent, but has come to live here in the flesh in this person of Jesus. And what does that mean, that you have this God again who visibly moves with the people and isn't stuck in a house and a temple?
Isn't the word flesh also used because the Gnostics were in the spirit mind? Flesh was evil, and mind and the spirit, and that was good. And when they left the flesh, they arrived. And, we have that in the... when we think of eternal life, too. We say those people are in heaven. You know, the thing that we're dealing with, do we deal with the resurrection from the dead? Or do we deal with the Pleo idea of the spirit goes to heaven? That was the Gnostic feeling. So when we get flesh here,
It grounds us.
That's a bad word for that. Because flesh is evil.
So it's almost reclaiming of it too, and which strangely, I mean, in our history too, we still kind of see in our the more media based Christianity, or. I don't really know how to say it, but it seems like the conventional wisdom on Christianity is that flesh is bad and spirit is good. And we've really taken a lot of those Pauline passages, too, to just rail on the flesh. And here, this is a beautiful reclaiming of that, saying, hey, God became flesh and lived and pitched his tent with us. That to me is exciting. I don't have any drum rolls or anything to tell you how excited I am about that, but I love that. I do have an image of that. Is that when I was on a reservation, it was in Wind River Reservation in Wyoming, and it was a Catholic church, and you know how the Catholic Church keeps the host or the body of Christ, they'll like bless it, and then they'll keep it there all week long and stuff, and they have what they call a tabernacle actually over it. And this was the Arapaho and Shoshone people, and so their Catholic Church actually had a Catholic Church on the reservation had a little teepee over it. So it was this tent, which made so much sense. And in actual honesty, rather than being a really glorious type of, many of the Catholic churches have, it was just this humble thing of, that moves with us with a people that would have understood that. So it was really... get excited about that. Then we go on to full of grace and truth. And for we have seen from his fullness we have received grace upon grace. And that word for grace is charis, so that'd be the word for charity. We've seen, it could also be, some have wanted to translate this like steadfast love. I have made an argument of how this is similar to the Old Testament idea of steadfast love and mercy, because mercy and grace are kind of related. So full of, as we have seen, his glory, the glory as of a father's only son, full of grace and truth. And I'd like to ask a question, is what do you think glory means? That is not a word that we use every day. But in the light of this verse, we might be able to find some meaning of what glory is. Doxa, like doxology, when we, you know, we also use that word for praise, but what does it mean to see God's glory?
Their first thought was light.
Light. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. You think of light. That would actually go really well with testifying to the light. So there's something. Yeah, that's getting at it.
Something, when you said that, I was thinking the glory as of the Father's only Son.
Hmm.
And so that we see a glimpse of who the Father is by the Son, you know, like an inherited thing, or the image, or what possibly the no, not that the, like say mother daughter, I'll use mm-hmm. that that Charlie has taken upon attributes that mm-hmm. I have instilled upon her, or something like this, and so then you can see if she were by herself, you would say, oh, well, she's like Kathleen, or she's, mm-hmm. you know, she's taken upon some glory. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so then I kind of see that as his own, as the Father's only Son, using mm-hmm. that kind of parallel, that we then can have a glimpse as Jesus is walking the earth and becoming flesh,
mm-hmm.
how many times he referred to, you know, I am the Father and we are one,
mm-hmm.
and getting a glimpse of what God is like,
mm-hmm.
that loving, the healing, the compassion.
I think, Kathleen, you just nailed it on the head, because a word that goes really well with glory, or that it can be translated to also, is manifest, to be made manifest. And I think when I finally discovered that, I finally got glory. Because otherwise it just seemed like this really big word that I sing in songs and I don't get it. but yeah, and so what you're saying is that when your attributes are manifest in Charlie, you know, you see a little bit
of that manifest. And it would obviously be different.
Yeah, God, Jesus. You know. Yeah. Kathleen, Charlie. But yeah. So this idea of, and I liked your phrase too, getting a glimpse of God. I think that's something too to put in there. I wish that could all be put in one English word and they would just say it right there, because glory doesn't tick as many of those images as much immediately for us any longer. But
that's,
needs to be explained a little bit more. Yes, Stacy.
That Kathleen said that, because my first reaction when I think of glory, if I get a picture in my mind, something that is just all-encompassing, that shows the whole picture. So there's kind of like this paradox where you were talking about like this glimpse of something, yet when I think of the combination of words of in all its glory, in all of God's glory. So it's just like in a brief moment, everything making mm-hmm. sense, like it's there, mm-hmm. and yet
360 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yet it's not, because we don't know, but it's just like it's so quick that we see it for all that it is, that we can't mm-hmm. even comprehend all of it, but that's, there's a mystery in glory.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Annie Dillard talks about that this tree that she saw.
Oh, yes.
But she calls it on fire. It wasn't on mm-hmm. fire, but it was just, you know, one of those things that just happened, the light, and she was standing in the right place, and it just seemed as though the whole tree was just shining, and it was just like, you know, it was this brief moment of just like that brief moment of experiencing everything and the whole, you know, not just 360 degrees this way, but every way. And so the whole sphere was
just make sense.
That's interesting that you say that, because I've done, this summer I did a Madden's three different times on that exact piece in Annie Dillard, and I talked about that. And I used the word glory, and I talked about being invited into something and not fully knowing that you are a part of it, or you're invited into this light, like in how Annie Dillard says in that piece. She didn't expect to be there with this magnificent thing, and all of a sudden it just made sense. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what God's calling it. All of a sudden makes sense for a moment.
Hmm. Yeah, there is that. I think too, for me too, that glory has that mystery. I mean, it's a word you can't really unfold it to its heart. It's because the heart, there's always more deeper meanings, and you know, mm-hmm. the more you understand glory, the less you understand it.
Hmm.
I had some also. For some reason, this triggered
mm-hmm.
Something that Susan Brill had said, I think it was last Christmas when we were talking about the tree of life, that, because it was about Jesus' ancestors in Matthew. And she said that the Hebrew thought was, or I don't know, maybe all the thought, the ancient world was, the homunculus, is that what it's called? That anyway, that the father...
Oh, how they did birth?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't mention that.
That the father's seed that was planted mm-hmm. was a teeny, teeny, tiny person.
Yeah.
And that it was the real person that was implanted in the woman. And so, and she was talking about them, you know, so that when people were barren, when women were barren, that meant that they were not giving hospitality to their husband's children.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, when I saw that it says the father's only son, you know, that this was, you know,
the little person.
teeny tiny God in there, you know. And so, you know, so that the glory part then was the glory of God.
Mm-hmm.
That mystery and awe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good.
And this was his only son.
Mm-hmm.
That's, well, not his.
There. So I think with this comes, once again, I just lay out the themes of that abundant life that has been given to us, testifying to the light not that we are, but a reflection to testify to this light. And... and that we see a God who, or we experience a word becoming flesh, which is not a bad thing, but a kind of a reclaiming of our flesh, the word becoming flesh and dwelling among us, pitching God's tent among us and being with us wherever it is that we as a people are. It's an image that Matthew uses the image God with you, Emmanuel, calling Jesus that. And John uses the image of pitching a tent with us. So always that presence of God in this word. And that idea that, just taking it one step further, is that in 2:19 in John, if you turn to 2:19, right at the beginning of this gospel, you have Jesus, people are asking, what sign can you do, to show us we're doing this? And Jesus says, right at the beginning, Jesus answered them, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. Again, we have this image of Jesus and the tabernacle, Jesus and this temple, together, that he will destroy this temple and raise it up in himself and who he is. And then the rest of the book is the journey towards that. So just keeping that in mind of God not being in a box that's, you know, that we visit, but that is on God, this God in John, this Jesus guy is definitely on the loose. And that's the promise. That's the promise for us, is that Jesus is on the loose with us, wreaking havoc. Yes, with us, and That's the Emmanuel message that, that John has, is pitching a tent with us. So enjoy. Thanks for your time. I think it's snack time.